The White Rose was the name of a nonviolent intellectual resistant group in Nazi Germany consisting of students from the University of Munich and their philosophy professor. The group became known for anonymous leaflet and graffiti campaign lasting from June 1942 until February 1943, calling for active opposition to dictator Adolf Hitler's regime. The six most recognized members of the group were arrested by the Gestapo and beheaded in 1943. The text of their leaflet was smuggled, and a lot of their copies were dropped off over Germany by Allied planes. And there were the White Rose Society is honored in Germany as some of the greatest heroes in the resistance to the Third Reich in the face of almost certain death. There were others at the time also, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Confessing Church, which stood against the Protestants and the Catholics. There was Corrie ten Boom. There was a lot of resistance. Nevertheless, The White Rose has had some movies written or produced about the life of Sophie Scholl. And there is a book called The White Rose put out by Inga Scholl. And I'm going to go over some of the, and Wikipedia, we all know Wikipedia, although some of the information is rather sketchy and questionable because of editing issues, but you can get a general overview of that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an overview of the White Rose Society. I'm going to read you some selected passages from the White Rose by Inga Scholl about the trial and execution of the key members, some of their statements, and then I'm going to read you the, I believe, the first and the third leaflet. These people are people who should inspire us. The White Rose was birthed out of Hitler's Germany, a government controlling everything: the news, media, arms, police, armed forces, judiciary system, communications, travel, all levels of education, all cultural and religious institutions. Political indoctrination starts at a very early age and continues by means of Hitler Youth with the ultimate goal of complete mind control. It is about control. Totalitarian, dictatorial control. Children were exhorted in school to denounce even their own parents for derogatory remarks about Hitler or Nazi ideology. This was a testimony by Jürgen Wittgenstein that his own cousin threatened to denounce his father, and he was barely able to deter him by pointing out that he himself might end up destitute if father was arrested and incarcerated. Members of the White Rose Society were Hans Scholl, his sister Sophie Scholl, and Christopher Probst, students from the University of Munich, comprised the core of the White Rose. Hans Scholl, Sophie Scholl, Alex Schmorl, who was canonized a martyr in the Orthodox Church, Willy Graf, Christopher Probst, Trudy Loughran, Katharina Schidkoff, Leslie Lott, Lilo Berndt, Jürgen Wittgenstein, Marie-Louise Jahn, and Falk Harnack. Most of these people were in their early 20s. The professor of philosophy and musicology, Kurt Huber, was associated with their cause, and additionally William Geyer, Manfred Eckmeyer, Joseph Schoenig, and Harold Doran participated in their debates. Geyer taught Alexander Schmorl how to make templates used in the graffiti campaign. Eugen Grimminger of Stuttgart funded their operation. And Grimminster Secretary Tilly Hahn contributed her own funds to the cause and act as a go-between for the duplicating machine from Stuttgart to Munich. In addition, a group of high school students in the city of Ulm distributed a number of the group's leaflets. Among these were Hans Holzer and Franz Mueller. Between 1942 in June and February 1943, the group prepared and distributed leaflets in which they called for the active opposition of the German people to Nazi oppression and tyranny. Hubert wrote the final leaflet, a draft of a seventh leaflet designed by Christoph Probst was found in possession of Hans Scholl at the time of his arrest by the Gestapo. While Sophie Scholl hid incriminating evidence on her person before being taken into custody, Hans did not do the same with Probst's leaflet draft or cigarette coupons given to him by Geyer, an act that cost Probst his life and nearly undid Geyer. Hans did try to destroy the draft of the last leaflet by ripping it into pieces and stuffing it into his mouth to try to save Probst from detection, but the Gestapo recovered enough to match with written signed statements from Probst found later in Hans' apartment. The Right Rose was influenced by the German youth movement, of which Christopher Probst was a member. Hans Scholl was a member of the Hitler Youth until 1937, and Sophia was a member of the Bund Deutsche Mädel. Membership of both groups was compulsory for young Germans, although many such as Willy Graft, Otto Eicher, and Heinz Brenner refused to join. The ideas of Deutsche Jungenschaft had strong influence on Hans Scholl and his six colleagues, was a youth group of the German youth movement and founded by Eberhard Kobel in 1929. Willy Graf was a member of New Deutschland, a Catholic youth association, and the Grauer Orden. The group was motivated by ethical and moral considerations. They came from various religious backgrounds. Willy and Katharina were devout Catholics. The Scholls, Lilo, and Falk were just as devoutly Lutheran. Alexander Schmorl was Orthodox, the grandson of a priest, and eventually glorified as an Orthodox Christian saint. Trutti adhered to the concepts of anthroposophy, while Eugen Grimminger considered himself Buddhist. Christopher Probst was baptized a Catholic shortly before his execution. His father, Hermann, was nominally a Catholic, but for some time studied Eastern thought and wisdom. The reason why his son Christoph was not baptized as a baby. In the summer of 42, the male medical students at the University of Munich were obliged to serve 3 months stint on the Russian front. The idea was to send medical students to the Russian front for a period of 3 months for them to experience the rendering of medical care under fire and to work as physician assistants in field hospital. Several White Rose members were among them, where they witnessed the horrors of war and the unbelievable cruelty the Germans displayed to the Jews. After observing beatings and mistreatments and reliable stories of the persecution of the Jews in full swing and the atrocities of war on the battlefield against civilian population in the East, they could not morally and ethically get the images of brutality out of their minds, and they returned in November 1942, rejecting fascism and militarism and believed in a federated Europe that would adhere to principles of tolerance and justice. Quoting in the leaflets extensively from the Bible, Aristotle and Novalis, as well as Goethe and Schiller, they appealed to what they considered the German intelligentsia, believing that they would be intrinsically opposed to Nazism. These leaflets were left in telephone books and public phone books, booths, mailed to professors and students, and taken by courier to other universities for distribution. At first, the leaflets were sent out in mailing from cities of Bavaria and Austria, since the members believed that southern Germany would be more receptive to their anti-militaristic message. The White Rose, Munich, 1942, 1943, Inga Scholl. the white rose. In the warm spring-like days of early February, after the Battle of Stalingrad, I was riding in a commuter train from Munich to Solln. Next to me in the railway compartment sat two party members who were discussing in whispers the latest news from Munich. "Down with Hitler" had been painted in large white letters on the university walls. Leaflets calling for resistance to the regime had been scattered, and the city had been shaken as if by an earthquake. Everything was still standing. Life went on as before, but beneath the surface, something had changed. I could tell as much from the conversation of the two men sitting opposite one another in the compartment. Putting their heads together, they talked about the end of the war and what they would do when it would suddenly confront them. "The only thing I will be able to do is to shoot myself," said one of them. He glanced quickly in my direction to see whether I'd overheard him. No doubt these two breathed easier when, a few days later, flaming red posters were displayed to calm the populace. They announced, "Sentenced to death for high treason, Christopher Probst, age 24, Hans Scholl, age 25, Sophie Scholl, age 22. The sentences have already been carried out." The newspapers carried reports of irresponsible lone wolves and adventurers who, by their acts, had automatically excluded themselves from the community of the Volk. The rumors had spread that up to 100 persons had been apprehended and that more death sentences could be expected. The president of the People's Court had been flown expressly in from Berlin to execute swift judgment. In a subsequent court action, the following were also condemned and executed: Willy Graf, Professor Kurt Huber, Alexander Schmorell. What had these people done? What was their crime? While some people mocked and vilified them, others described them as heroes of freedom. But were they heroes? They attempted no superhuman task. They stood up for a simple matter, an elementary principle: the right of the individual to choose his manner of life and to live in freedom. They did not seek martyrdom in the name of any extraordinary idea. They were not chasing after grandiose aims. They wanted to make it possible for people like you and me to live in a humane society. Perhaps their greatness lies in the fact that they committed themselves for the sake of such a simple matter, that they were strong enough to give their lives in defense of the most elementary right. It is perhaps more difficult to stand up for a worthy cause when there is no general enthusiasm, no great idealistic upsurge, no high goal, no supporting organization, and thus no obligation. When, in short, one risks one's life on one's own and in lonely isolation, perhaps genuine heroism lies in deciding stubbornly to defend the everyday things, the trivial and the immediate, after having been bombarded with so much oratory about great deeds. The tranquil town in Kochertal, where we lived as children, seemed forgotten by the world. Our only communication with the outside was the yellow mail coach that carried us over a long, bumpy road to the railroad station. But my father, the mayor, was disturbed by the inconvenience of our isolation, and finally he prevailed over the conservative local farmers in a long struggle to build a branch line connecting us with the railway. To us children, however, the world of this little town was not narrow, but rich, great, and splendid. We also soon learned that the world did not end at the horizon where the sun rose and set, and one day the wheels of our beloved railway carried us and all our belongings far away across the Schwaben Jura. We had taken a great leap when we got off the train in Ulm, that city on the Danube which was henceforth to be our home. Ulm, the name sounded to us like the boom of the biggest bell in a mighty cathedral. At first we were homesick, of course, but soon new things captured our attention, in particularly Hochschule, secondary school, in which the five of us were enrolled in term. One morning I heard a girl tell another on the steps of the school, "Now Hitler has taken over the government." The radio and newspapers promise, "Now there will be better times in Germany. Hitler is at the helm." For the first time, politics had come into our lives. Hans was 15 at the time, Sophia was 12. We heard much oratory about der Vaterland, comradeship, unity of the Volk, and love of country. This was impressive, and we listened closely when we heard such talk in school and on the street. For we loved our land dearly, the woods, the river, the old gray stone fences running along the steep slopes between the orchards and vineyards. We sniffed the odor of moss, damp earth, and sweet apples whenever we thought of our homeland. Every inch of it was familiar, dear, our fatherland. What was it but the extended home of all those who shared a language and belonged to one people? We loved it, though we couldn't say why. After all, up to now we hadn't talked very much about it. But now these things were being written across the sky in flaming letters. And Hitler. So we heard on all sides, Hitler would keep his fatherland to achieve greatness, fortune, and prosperity. He would see to it that everyone had work and bread. He would not rest until every German was independent, free, and happy in his fatherland. We found this good, and we were willing to do all we could to contribute to the common effort. But there was something else that drew us with mysterious power and swept us along. The closed ranks of marching youth with banners waving, eyes fixed straight ahead, keeping time to drumbeat and song. Was not this a sense of fellowship overpowering? It is not surprising that all of us, Hans and Sophie and the others, joined the Hitler Youth. We entered into it with body and soul, and we could not understand why our father did not approve, why he was not happy and proud. On the contrary, he was quite displeased with us. At times he would say, "Don't believe them. They are wolves and deceivers, and they are misusing the German people shamefully." Sometimes he would compare Hitler to the Pied Piper of Hamelin, who with his flute led the children to destruction. But father's words were spoken to the wind, and his attempts to restrain us were of no avail against our youthful enthusiasm. We went on trips with our comrades in the Hitler Youth and took long hikes through our new land, the Schwabenjura. No matter how long and strenuous a march we made, we were too enthusiastic to admit that we were tired. After all, it was splendid suddenly to find common interests and allegiance with young people whom we might otherwise not have gotten to know at all. We attended evening gatherings in our various homes, listened to reading, sang, played games, or worked at handcrafts. They told us that we must dedicate our lives to a great cause. We were taken seriously in a more remarkable way, and that aroused our enthusiasm. We felt we belonged to a large, well-organized body that honored and embraced everyone, from the 10-year-old to the grown man. We sensed that there was a role for us in a historic process, in a movement that was transforming the masses into a Volk. We believed that whatever bored us or gave us a feeling of distaste would disappear of itself. One night, as we lay under the wide starry sky, after a long cycling tour, a friend, a 15-year-old girl, said quite suddenly and out of the blue, "Everything would be fine, but this thing about the Jews is something I just can't swallow." The troop leader assured us that Hitler knew what he was doing and that for the sake of the greater good, we would have to accept certain difficult and incomprehensible things. But the girl was not satisfied with this answer. Others took her side, and suddenly the attitudes in our varying home backgrounds were reflected in the conversation. We spent a restless night in that tent. But afterwards, we were just too tired, and the next day was inexpressibly splendid and filled with new experiences. The conversation of the night before was, for the moment, forgotten. In our groups, there developed a sense of belonging that carried us safely through the difficulties and loneliness of adolescence, or at least gave us that illusion. Hans had learned a repertoire of songs, and his troop enjoyed hearing him sing to his own guitar accompaniment. He sang not only the songs of the Hitler Youth, but also folk songs of many countries and peoples. What a magical effect the singing of a Russian or Norwegian song could produce with its gloomy, impelling melancholy. How much it told about these people and their lands. But after a time, Hans underwent a remarkable change. He became a different person. Some disturbing element had entered his being. This had nothing to do with Father's objections. He was able to close his ears to those. It was something else. The leaders had told him that his songs were not allowed. And when he made light of this prohibition, they threatened punishment. Why should he be forbidden to sing these songs that were so full of beauty? Merely because they had been created by other races? He could see no sense in it. He was depressed, and his lighthearted manner disappeared. At this time, he was honored with a very special assignment. He was chosen to be the flag bearer when his troop attended the party rally in Nuremberg. His joy was great, but when we returned, we could not believe our eyes. He looked tired and showed signs of a great disappointment. We did not expect any explanation from him, but gradually we found out that the image and model of the Hitler Youth, which had been impressed upon him, there was totally different from his own ideal. The official view demanded discipline and conformity, down to the last detail, including personal life. While he would have wanted every boy to follow his own bent and give free play to his talents. The individual should enrich the life of the group with his own contribution of imagination and ideas. In Nuremberg, however, everything was directed according to a set pattern. Day and night, the talk was about true loyalty. But what was the foundation of true? After all, being true to oneself, rebellion was stirring in Hans's mind. Soon afterwards, a new prohibition upset him. One of the leaders snatched out of his hand a book by his famous, one of his favorite author, Sternstunden der Menschheit by Stefan Zweig. It was banned, he was told. But why? There was no answer. A similar judgment was pronounced against another German author whom Hans liked very much. This man had had to flee Germany because he had defended the idea of peace. Finally, the open break came. Sometime before, Hans had been promoted to the rank of Fahnenführer, troop leader. He and his boys had sewn a handsome banner bearing in its design a great mythical beast. This flag was something special. It was dedicated to the Führer, and the boys had pledged their loyalty to the banner because it was a symbol of their fellowship. One evening, however, when they had come into formation with their banner and stood in review before a higher echelon leader, the unheard of happened. The leader suddenly, without warning, ordered the little flag bearer, a cheerful 12-year-old, to hand over the banner. "You don't need a banner of your own. Use the one prescribed for everyone." Hans was deeply disturbed. Since when this rule? Didn't a cadre leader know what this particular flag meant to the troop? After all, it was not just another piece of cloth that could be changed at will. The order to hand over the banner was repeated. The boy stood rigid, and Hans knew how he felt and that he would refuse. When the order was given for a third time in a threatening voice, Hans noted that the flag was trembling. At that, he lost control. He quietly stepped from his place in the ranks and slapped the cadre leader. That put an end to Hans's career as Fahnenführer. The spark of tormenting doubt which was kindled in Hans spread to the rest of us. In those days, we heard a story about a young teacher who had unaccountably disappeared. He had been ordered to stand before an SA squad, and each man was ordered to pass by the teacher and to spit in his face. After that incident, no one saw him again. He had disappeared into a concentration camp. "What did he do?" we asked his mother in bewilderment. "Nothing, nothing," she cried out in despair. "He just wasn't a Nazi. It was impossible for him to belong. That was his crime." Oh, God, at that, the doubts which had arisen soon turned to deep sadness and then burst into a flame of rebellion. Within us, the world of purity and faith was crumbling bit by bit. What was really happening to our fatherland? No freedom, no flourishing life, no prosperity or happiness for anyone who lived in it. Gradually, one bond after another was clamped around Germany until finally all were imprisoned in a great dungeon. "Father, what is a concentration camp?" He told us what he knew and suspected and added, "That is war. War in the midst of peace and with our own people. War against the defenseless individual. War against human happiness and the freedom of his children. It is a frightful crime." But perhaps the tormenting disappointment was only a bad dream from which we would awaken in the morning. In our hearts arose a violent struggle. We tried to defend our ideas against everything we had seen and heard. But does the Fuhrer have any idea of the concentration camps? How could he not know, since they've existed for years and were set up by his closest friends? And why didn't he use his power to do away with them at once? Why are those who are released from them forbidden on pain of death to tell anything about what they went through? There awoke in us a feeling of living in a house once beautiful and clean, but in whose cellars behind locked doors, frightful, evil, and fearsome things were happening. And as doubt had slowly taken hold of us, so now there grew within us horror, fear, and the first germ of unbounded uncertainty. But how is it possible that in our country a thing like this could take over the government? In a time of great troubles, explained Father, all sorts come to the surface. Just recall the bad times we had to live through. The war, then the difficult post-war years, inflation and great poverty, then came unemployment. If a man's bare existence is undermined and his future is nothing but a gray impenetrable wall, he will listen to promises and temptations and not ask who offers them. But after all, Hitler did keep his promise to do away with unemployment. No one denies that. But don't ask about his methods. He started up the munitions industry. He's building barracks. Do you know where that will lead? He could have eliminated unemployment by means of peacetime industries. In a dictatorship, that can easily be managed. But surely we are not like cattle, satisfied if we have fodder for our bellies. Material security alone will never be enough to make us happy. After all, we're human beings with free opinions and our own beliefs. A regime which would tamper with these things has lost every spark of respect for man. Yet that is the first thing which we must demand from it. This talk between Father and ourselves occurred on a long hike in the spring. Once again, we had thoroughly talked out our questions and doubts. What I want most of all is that you live in uprightness and freedom of spirit. No matter how difficult that proves to be, he added, suddenly we were comrades, our father and ourselves, and none of us were conscious that he was so much older. We had the welcome sensation of seeing our horizons widen, and at the same time we understood that this expansion of the world brought with it dangerous risks. Now, our family was a small, stable island in the ever stranger, incomprehensible swirl of events. But along with this feeling, there was something else for Hans and my younger brother, Werner, something which gave shape to our lives in the years between 14 and 18, and which filled them with indescribable high spirits. That was their association with a small group of friends in Jugendschaft, an organization which existed in various German cities, particularly where the cultural life was still active. Was the last remaining splinter of the disbanded Bündnis Jugend and had actually long since been allied by the Gestapo. The club had its own most impressive style, which had grown up out of the membership itself. The boys recognized one another by their dress, their songs, even their way of talking. I do not know whether such a phenomena can be described at all. It has to be experienced at first hand. For these boys, life was a great, splendid adventure, an expedition into an unknown, beckoning world. On weekends, they went on hikes, and it was their way, even in the bitter cold, to live in a tent, such as the Lapps used in the Arctic. Seated around the campfire, they would read aloud to each other or sing, accompanying themselves with guitar, banjo, and balalaika. They collected the folk songs of all peoples and wrote words and music for their own ritual chants and popular songs. They painted and took photographs, wrote and composed, and out of the results, they put together their magnificent and inimitable excursion books and magazines. In winter, they climbed the most remote meadow slopes and skied down them the most daring breakneck runs. They loved to practice with their foils in the early dawn. They carried certain favorite books that opened to them new dimensions of the world and of their inner selves. They were solemn and silent. With their own peculiar sense of humor, they had whole buckets of sarcasm, mockery, and skepticism. They could race through the woods in wild, unrestrained excitement, plunge into icy cold rivers during early mornings, then for hours on end lie on their stomachs watching the game and the wild fowl. At concerts, they would just sit as still, with bated breath, drinking in the music. If a good film happened to be in town, they turned up at the movies or in the theater when a play aroused their interest. They explored the museums and were well acquainted with the cathedral and its most inaccessible splendors. In a special way, they loved the blue horses of Franz Marc, the vibrant fields and sons of Van Gogh, and the exotic world of Gauguin. But none of this conveys anything precise. And perhaps it's better not to be precise, because they themselves were so uncommunicative as they quietly grew into adulthood and into life. One of their favorite songs went, "Close eye and ear a while against the tumult of the time. You'll not steal it or find peace until your heart is pure. As you watch and wait to catch the eternal in the everyday, you freely choose to take your role in history's great play. The hour will come when you are called, but then prepared, be ready. The fire dies down, leap in. Again it blazes steady." And just a side note, the White Rose, the name of their society that came later, was from also allegedly from a song at the time. Suddenly there occurred throughout Germany a wave of arrests that wiped out these last remnants of a genuine youth movement, which had started at the beginning of the century with high expectations and a great spirit. For many of these young men, imprisonment was not of the great fruitful shocks of their young years. Many of them understood now that youth, the movement, and the club had come to an end, that they had to step into adult life. The diaries, magazines, and songbooks were seized and reduced to pulp. After weeks or months of prison, the young men were released. At that time, Hans wrote on the flyleaf of one of his favorite books, "Tear out our hearts, and they will fatally burn you." The time of youth would have had to end in any case, even without the Gestapo. Hans came to this realization as soon as he was face to face with the gray prison walls. Now he concentrated on his forthcoming education and decided to enter the field of medicine. Hans was aware that beauty, aesthetic pleasure, and existence in his passive growth to manhood were no longer enough, that these could no longer insulate him from the dangers of the times. He felt that there was a bottom, an acute emptiness, and that there were no answers to his difficult, profound, and disquieting question, not in Rilke, and not in Stefan George, not in Nietzsche, nor in Hölderlin, but he was sure that his honest search would lead him along the right path. Finally, by strange detours, he made the acquaintance of the ancient Greek philosophers Plato and Socrates. He stumbled upon the early Christian philosophers and occupied himself with the great St. Augustine. He discovered Pascal. The Bible took on a new and startling meaning. A sense of immediacy broke through the old and apparently worn-out words, giving them the authority of persuasive reality. Years had passed, meanwhile. The war within the country against single individuals had turned into the war against the nations, had become the Second World War. Hans had already started at the university when the war broke out. For the time being, he had been allowed to continue. Then he was drafted into a company of medics, and soon thereafter he took part in the campaign in France. Later, he was able to continue his studies, being assigned to a student company in Munich. It was an unusual kind of life, half soldier, half student, sometimes in the barracks, at other times at the university or the hospital. Two opposing ways of life, which he was not able to reconcile. This split existence was difficult enough, but the heavier and gloomier burden he had to bear was that he lived in a country where bondage, hatred, and falsehood had become the normal mode of existence. The vice-like rule of naked force was becoming tighter and even more unbearable. Each day of liberty was a gift, for no one was secure against arrest. One might be arrested in the street because of some trivial remark and disappear perhaps forever. Would he be surprised if tomorrow morning the Gestapo were come to his door and put an end to his freedom? Hans knew, of course, that he was but one of millions in Germany who felt as he did. But woe to him who dared to speak freely and openly. He would surely be shipped off to prison. Woe to the mother who gave vent to her feelings and cursed the war. It would be a long time before she could enjoy life again. All of Germany was spied upon and secret ears listened everywhere. On several occasions in the spring of 1942, we found hectographed letters in our mailbox. These carried excerpts from the sermon of Count Galen, Bishop of Munster, and they radiated an astonishing aura of integrity, of courage and integrity. The following is an excerpt from one of the letters of sermon of Count Galen, Bishop of Munster. All Munster lives under the impression of the frightful destruction the external enemy has inflicted upon us during the past week. Yesterday, the 12th of July, at the end of this week, the Gestapo confiscated two monasteries of the Society of Jesus in our city. They have driven the residents out of their properties and have ordered the priests and brothers on that same day not only to vacate their houses, but also to leave the states of Westphalia and the Rhineland. The same hard judgment was meted out yesterday to the sisters. The residents and properties, together with all the household goods, have been made over to the office of the Gallachar for Northern Westphalia. Thus, the attack on the convents and monasteries, which for some time now has raged in the eastern provinces, in southern Germany, in the newly won areas of Rottgau, Luxembourg, Lorraine, and other parts of the Reich, have begun here in Westphalia as well. What will come of this? It is not a matter of providing temporary shelter for the homeless people in Munster. The brothers in the order were ready and determined to give up, if necessary, their residence, to take in the homeless as other people do and to provide them with food. No, this was not the problem. I've heard that the Gau Film Center is to be set up in the convent of the Immaculate Conception in Wilkenhage. I have been told that a lying-in hospital for unmarried mothers is to be installed in the Benedictine Abbey of St. Joseph. Today, no newspaper has carried stories about the bloodless victories won by the Gestapo officials over defenseless brothers and helpless German women, nor of the conquests which the Gauleiters have made of the goods of their German fellow citizens. Verbal protests and telegrams are in vain. We cannot take arms against the internal enemy who torments and conquers us. For us, there is but one weapon, strong, tenacious, and firm steadfastness. Become strong. Remain unshaken. Now we see clearly and learn quite explicitly what lies at the bottom of the new teaching to which we have been forced to listen all these years, and for the sake of which religious instruction has been banned from the schools, which has suppressed our organizations and now is about to destroy the nursery school. It amounts to a deep-running hatred of Christianity, which is scheduled to be rooted out. At this moment, we are not the hammer, but the anvil. Others, most of whom are outsiders and apostates, are hammering upon us. They have set about by force to reshape our people and even our youth, to turn them away from God. What they are now forging is illegal imprisonment, exile, and expulsion of the innocents. But God will stay by their side to help them maintain the form and spirit of Christian fortitude as the hammer of persecution strikes them bitterly and wounds without cause. For some months now, we have been hearing that mental patients who have been ill for a long time and are apparently incurable have been removed from the hospitals by force on orders from Berlin. Regularly, the relatives are informed after a short while that the patient has died, the body has been cremated, and the ashes may be called for. There is widespread suspicion verging on certainty that many of the unexpected deaths among mental patients have not been due to natural causes but have been deliberately arranged, and that the officials follow the precept that it's permissible to destroy life which does not deserve to live, to kill innocent persons. If it is decided that such lives are no longer of value to the Volk and the state, it is a terrible doctrine, which excuses the murder of innocent people, which gives express license to kill unemployable invalids, cripples, incurables, and the seniles and those who suffer from incurable disease. Upon reading these pages, home is deeply agitated. Finally, a man has the courage to speak out. Abstractedly, he studied the leaflets and said after a while, "We really ought to have a duplicating machine." In spite of everything, Hans' great joy in life could not be easily quenched. Indeed, the darker world about him became the brighter and stronger grew this power within him, and it increased and was strengthened after his experience of the war in France. Through such familiarity with death, life took on a special value. In those days, Hans was exceptionally lucky in the acquaintances he made. On a sunny day in autumn, he met the gray-haired editor of a well-known journal, which the Nazis had banned. Hans just happened to go to his house on a casual errand. But the old man's eyes looked intently at Hans, and after the man had exchanged a few words with him, he was invited to return. From then on, Hans was daily a visitor. For hours on end, he ranged through the immense library, the gathering ground of poets, scholars, and philosophers. 100 doors and windows into the world of the mind opened in converse with them. But he also saw that they existed like underground plants in the state of bondage, and that all of them expressed the same great yearning, to breathe freely again, to be able to work in freedom, and to be entirely themselves. Among the students, Hans also met some who shared his sentiments. One especially among them caught his attention because of his tall figure and his totally unmilitary, elegant, and carefree bearing. This was Alexander Schmorell, son of a well-known Munich physician. Soon a close friendship developed between them, starting from the instinctive unanimity with which the two of them were always ready to disrupt the dull barracks life with their practical jokes and clever tricks. There can be few men who had Alex's radiant, relaxed humor. He beheld the world with eyes full of imagination. It was as if he saw it anew each day. He found the world beautiful, fresh, and filled with captivating delights, and he enjoyed it in an open, childlike way without questioning or calculating. He was at once totally receptive and unstintingly generous, dispensing gifts royally. Sometimes, however, there appeared behind his cheerful, untrammeled manner something else, a questioning and seeking an ancient, deep-seated seriousness. He had come to Germany as an infant brought by his parents from Russia. Soon after, through Alex, Hans made another friend among the students, Christel Probst. Hans recognized at once that there was a bond between him and Christel, the same love of nature and all creation, the same response to books and writers. Christel had studied the stars and knew a great deal about the minerals and plants of the mountains of Upper Bavaria where he lived. His strongest tie with Hans, however, was their common search for the principle underlying all phenomena, underlying man and man's history. Christel admired and greatly respected his late father, a self-taught scholar. Maybe that his father's early death accounted in large measure for Crystal's exceptional maturity. He alone of the group of students was married. He had 2 sons, aged 2 and 3. For this reason, he was carefully excluded from political acts which might bring him into danger. Later, a 4th student joined the group, Willy Graf, a tall blonde boy from the Saar region. He was a rather taciturn fellow, thoughtful and reserved. When Hans got to know him, it was immediately evident that Willy belonged with him. He, too, was occupied intensely with problems of philosophy and theology. Sophie described him when he says anything in his very deliberate way. One has the impression that he would not speak unless he could commit himself with his whole being. That's why everything about him gives the impression of being precise, genuine, and wholly reliable. Willy's father, the head of a large business firm, was accustomed to having his son go his own way. Early in life, Willy had joined a Catholic youth club, and the wave of arrests which in 1938 had caught up Hans had also involved Willy. Now he, along with Christel, Alex, and Hans, was studying medicine. After a concert, they would meet in an Italian wine shop, but they soon came to feel very much at home in Hans's room or at Alex's house. They would recommend books to one another, read aloud, and hold discussions, but sometimes they would suddenly be seized by wild high spirits and invent all sorts of nonsense. Their excess of imagination, humor, and love of life had to be given vent from time to time. It was the eve of Sophie's 21st birthday. "It seems almost unbelievable that I'll be able to start at the university tomorrow," she had said to her mother on saying good night. Her mother, ironing, stood in the hall on the floor next to her, an open suitcase with clothes and fresh linen and all the little things that Sophie would need in her new life as a student. Alongside stood a handbag containing a crisp brown, sweet-smelling cake. Sophia bent down and sniffed it, and there next to it she discovered a bottle of wine. Sophia had to wait a long time for this day. It had been a difficult test of patience. First came a year of labor and service that seemed endless. Then, when she was ready to leap eagerly into a life of freedom, a new obstacle arose, a further half year of war aid service. She hated to be emotional about it, but how she had suffered. She had never been afraid of work, but she disliked what with it, working under orders, being herded together with the others in the camps, the deadly standardization. But these could still be borne if necessary, had not her convictions forced her into a state of continuous resistance. Was it an unforgivable sign of weak character if she gave the least bit of service to a state founded on lies, hatred, and bondage? "I want you to live in uprightness and freedom of spirit," her father had said. How unutterably difficult that could be. Sometimes Sophia had felt that this was conflict was unbearable, and she isolated herself from the girls in the labor service. She kept in the background and tried to give the impression of not being there at all. Let the other girls think what they please. So she learned to know homesickness and loneliness. She had held on to two things from home, however, from the other world. They were like moorings in the sea of strangeness and senselessness. The one was the need, perhaps it was a protection against a hostile environment, to care for her body with special pains. For the other, her spirit sought to support in the thoughts of St. Augustine. It was strictly forbidden to keep one's own books, but Sophia's volume of St. Augustine was hidden in a safe place. In those years, there was a renaissance of theological literature ranging from the early church fathers to the scholastics, with St. Thomas Aquinas as the central figure, and it embraced also their bold successors in modern French philosophy and theology. This resistance had also attracted certain groups standing outside the established faiths. In Augustine, Sophia discovered the words written, as it seemed, just for her and which suited her exactly, though they were already 1,000 years old. "Thou madest us for thyself, and our heart is restless until it reposes in thee." Confessions. No, this was not the same state as a child's homesickness. It was much more, and Sophia sometimes had the feeling that the world was infinitely strange, empty, and God-forsaken void. Through specialization and organization, men had developed the capacity to build a delicately complex structure of civilization, but again and again they denied their being and destroyed each other's achievements. In the end, not only their works, but themselves as well. Sophia had discovered a small chapel near the camp and had visited it at times. It had been pleasant to sit at the organ and play, or to idle and daydream, listening to the sounds of nature. Then her shattered world was gently rebuilt and took on a sense of order and meaning. In her free time, she slipped out into the large park surrounding the camp with its encircling woods and meadows. There she had lain very still, herself a tiny part of the natural order. How beautiful was the outline of a fir tree. How undisturbed and calmly a tree like this lived out its time. How beautiful the moss on the trunk, nourishing itself on the tree with such easy dependence. Life, how immense and how hard to grasp. Sophia felt that her skin had become smooth and absorbent, as if it could inhale the magic, lovely existence of these objects. But then the inner conflict would burst forth again and draw all the world with it into her sorrow. But for the moment, she was free. Tomorrow, she would travel to Munich. She would take charge of her life, go to the university, to Hans. Her mother was still standing at her ironing, carefully smoothing a blouse. Now this girl, too, had grown up and was old enough to leave home. Her youngest, her stubborn little one. What would the future bring? A wave of hope engulfed her mother's thoughts. Sophia would manage no matter where she went. She had always succeeded, no matter what she had set out to do. Mother's thoughts wandered on about each child in turn. She paused in thinking about her youngest boy, now in Russia. What was he doing at that moment? If only the war were over. And they were all gathered at home around the table. Mother knelt down and closed the suitcase. "They are in God's care," she said as she turned to put the things away. Meanwhile, she hummed a song, noticing with a start that it was the lullaby with which she had often sung the children to sleep. Spread wide your wings. At times, Mother's tranquil heart was torn by a great unaccustomed worry. Some time ago in the early morning, the doorbell had rung, and three men from the Gestapo had come to speak with Father. First, they held a lengthy conversation with him, and then they searched the house. When they left, they took Father with them. On that day, we realized fully in our very bones that we were horribly helpless. What did a single individual matter in this state? He was a speck of dust to be flicked away with a finger. It was only through great good fortune, like a miracle, that Father was released, but it was impressed upon him that his case was not yet cleared. My father had been denounced by an employee to whom he had incautiously betrayed his private opinion of Hitler. The woman had heard him call Hitler God's scourge of mankind. What would happen now? Sometimes we had hopes that everything would be all right in the end. However, an icy, tormenting feeling would grip our hearts as if the paw of a monstrous beast were poised over us, ready to descend at any moment. And no one knew who the next victim would be. "This child shall come to no harm," sang Mother as she finished her song. Today, Sophie's joy and the busy preparations for her departure elbowed these troubles out of her mind.